we do a lot of economic development. And so, and we're doing it in areas that are remote and rural. And yeah. I would say that our food system works for some, but not for a lot, especially yeah. in the rural communities. It's just a simple matter of economics. It's much more expensive to go to a place and drop off a very little product than it is to go to one place and drop off a whole lot.
Welcome to the Unleash Generosity podcast, exploring the intersection of faith, service, philanthropy, and community. I'm your host, Aaron Scott. Thanks for listening in today. This episode, along with all the episodes of the Unleash Generosity podcast, can be found on the Unleash Generosity website, which is www.unleashgenerosity.org. You can also find the podcast on Apple Podcasts and on Google Podcasts. And do me a favor, please go on to Apple Podcasts and do a rating or a review. In some ways, today's episode is an expansion, a part two, if you will, of a conversation we started in episode 6. Last episode, we talked with the executive director of Second Harvest Food Bank of Northeast Tennessee, Rhonda Chafin. And we talked about one aspect of food, one important aspect that's really pressing at this point, and that's food insecurity, and particularly how that has been a growing challenge during the COVID-19 pandemic. We're going to talk a little bit more about food access and how that's been impacted during today's episode. We're going to talk a little bit about donating products to food pantries and things like that. But today's conversation actually gets into some other really interesting aspects and issues related to food and related to food ethics. The agriculture system that produces or grows our food. What is it like to be a farmer trying to grow food and make a living? What are the factors that these folks consider when they decide what to grow and how much to grow and how to grow it, organic or not, and where to try to sell it at a farmer's market or to direct consumers? Today's guest is Kathleen Terry Baker, and she's the executive director of Appalachian Sustainable Development, or ASD. For a quarter century, they've been helping farmers in Central Appalachia who are really thinking about these questions that I just mentioned, and really helping our agriculture sector as a whole survive, adapt, and navigate a very changing environment. Before we jump into the conversation with Kathleen, though, I want to stress a point that comes up towards the end of the episode, but I think is important for all of us to keep in mind as we listen to the entire conversation, but also just as we have conversations about really any ethical conversation. It's easy to listen to a conversation about food and food ethics and to delve into a conversation like this and to feel like the comments that are being made are judgy or judgmental towards people that make certain decisions with their food dollars or how they are living currently. That really isn't the goal of this conversation. The goal isn't to shame people for the choices they're currently making. I certainly have my own bad habits and food choice decisions that I don't feel great about or things that I acknowledge I need to change. And also the ability to say that we have the ability to choose is a recognition that some of us have a choice. And there are certainly many people who do not have the privilege of thinking a lot about where to choose to buy food and the choice about whether to buy an organic tomato or just whatever is the cheapest or the most convenient place to shop. And you don't have a lot of choice. So the goal of this discussion is not to demean anyone's choices, but it's really to ask important questions about our food system, about where our food comes from, and about how all that's interconnected. And to simply ask questions are there ways that we can be more thoughtful and intentional about our food and what we eat and what the impacts are? What are the implications of choosing to eat those things and the way that that has an impact on our economy, on the planet, on our neighbors? So let's jump into the conversation with Kathleen. All right. right. Well, thanks for joining me. Welcome to the Unleash Generosity podcast.
Thank you.
Why don't you start by telling us a little bit about you? Give us some background.
So my name is Kathleen Terry Baker, and the organization I work for is Appalachian Sustainable Development, which is a 25-year-old nonprofit. And we've spent the last 25 years trying to find ways to help people stay in the region and thrive, to earn income from their land, and also to help people get access to fresh, healthy food. We do a lot of focusing on removing barriers to markets. So if a farmer needs some support in distribution or education or certification, whatever it might be, those are the kinds of things we focus on to enable the farmers and food producers in our region to have access to markets, which we know a lot of the bigger markets are not very close to where we are.
Interesting. Give us a little bit more background about you. Like, how does one have the expertise and knowledge, and how does one be so lucky to get appointed to become the director of an organization doing this kind of work?
Well, I started at ASD back in 2006 as their first ever business operations manager. And I actually came to the nonprofit sector from private industry. I guess I had a midlife crisis and decided I wanted to get up every day knowing that I was making a difference.
Sure.
In hindsight, I also thought I was going to look for less stress. And I definitely didn't look too closely at that, apparently. But it's been an amazing 14 years. So in 2011 is when I became the executive director.
Now you're in the executive director role. Have you had to develop certain skill sets that weren't required of you in the private sector? You've got volunteer management and you've got to be control of the budget, every aspect of the organization. What's that been like for you?
It's been 14 years of like the steepest learning curve ever. But also, I think one of the things that I've taken from being in the nonprofit sector versus private industry is that you have to, in the nonprofit sector, just keep pushing. You can try something, you fail, you start over again. And that's not dramatically different from private industry, but I think it is just something you have to become more comfortable with in the nonprofit sector, because the things that we're doing don't work right now. So especially if you look at like some of the social situations that are going on, no one has the exact answer. And so we know that. And the same with our local food system. We don't have all the answers. We have some of them. And so we just have to keep pushing and being creative.
That's interesting, because when we as a society think about innovation and offering like new solutions, we don't typically think about the nonprofit sector. So when you said like, you know, we try things and fail and then we have to innovate and try again, like that's really interesting. And I think that's absolutely true. It's just, it's interesting that that's not the perception. I think the perception is that like organizations just kind of do their little niche thing, you know? So if you help kids, then you help kids. And if you help families or you deal with food insecurity or raising money for cancer or whatever your organization does, that's what you do. And that's maybe a side of the nonprofit sector that people don't see, is you're consistently trying to identify new sources of funding. If you lose a source of funding, you're having to try to find another source. You're trying to be innovative about new programs that, you know, solution oriented to, you know, problems that are changing. But I think we're all more cognizant of the idea that we have to be innovative because we have seen those gaps. You know, COVID has exposed that our normal infrastructure, our normal pipelines, our normal delivery systems, we're realizing that they're not as resilient as we want them to be.
And I would say, you know, part of the reason that ASD has to do so much trying to create is because we do a lot of economic development. And so, and we're doing it in areas that are remote and rural. And yeah. I would say that our food system works for some, but not for a lot, especially in the rural communities where it's much more expensive it's just a simple matter of economics. It's much more expensive to go to a place and drop off very little product than it is to go to one place and drop off a whole lot. It just takes creativity and partnerships. I think one of the things that I've seen during this current pandemic situation is that a lot of the local food system infrastructure that has been being built over the last several years actually works. It actually was able to pivot. Farmers have seen, especially the ones who do direct to consumer sales, saw a 4- and 5-fold increase from the previous year. When you are able to pivot and serve that, it's pretty gratifying, because it's like, hey, maybe this can actually work.
Yeah. And it reinforces like, oh, I do have something people want. Like I have something of value to offer. Like, this is great. Tell us more about, I mean, you used a term there that I think can be broad and encompassing, and I'm maybe going to show my little bit of knowledge and maybe my ignorance by saying, like, so what are examples of direct to consumer? Would that be like a CSA program?
Yes. So that's a really good question. So when I say direct to consumer, I'm thinking more like a community supported agriculture subscription or a farmer's market, or just some of our partners are actually delivering direct to consumers, just like a food box.
Yeah.
So the shorter the supply chain, the more secure you will find it is in a situation like this. So a lot of what ASD's Food Hub does, which is located in Scott County, Virginia, is to deliver to grocery store chains. We do that in the Mid-Atlantic. So again, it's not coming from super far away. Yeah. But it's not as short a supply chain as it is if it's a farmer directly providing food to a consumer.
Yeah. And that, I mean, so both of those, relatively speaking, would be examples of local food, like supporting local farmers, because produce grown in the Mid-Atlantic, like in Southwest Virginia, and delivered even to the other side of the state of Virginia is relatively local compared to buying, you know, some of those same products from a grocery store, and the product was grown somewhere in South America or Mexico or California. So that's, you know, in a relative sense, local, but there's a different type of local when it's literally, you know, your farmer, because he lives in the next town over.
Exactly.
And you're doing a community supported agriculture program in which you're participating in like a subscription where you commit to him or her, I'm going to pay for a certain amount of food this growing season, and every week you're going to deliver me that box of food.
And I feel like we have this moment in time we need to capitalize on people's dawning understanding of how they can participate in their food system, because you can. And, you know, this is just a moment I feel when people can become more closely engaged with what they're eating and where it's coming from. That isn't to say that people aren't going to go to grocery store. You know, that's an unreasonable expectation, but understanding what you're buying at a grocery store and understanding when and how you can support local farmers is something that I think just takes thought and effort. And I think people are more engaged in that now. Just even the meat processing situation that we've all heard about during this time has raised some awareness, I think, of what concentrated animal feeding operations, like, how does that whole thing work? And what does that mean to my family and my table?
Yeah. I mean, how familiar were you with the role of local food or the challenges facing farmers or how food systems work? Were you familiar at all with that before 2006 when you first, I mean, so it really took you getting into working with an organization that actually does this to actually like become aware, like, oh, wow, like, I don't really know where my food comes from. Like, I give the money to the clerk at the grocery store, but how much of that's actually getting back to the farmer? That was a whole world that you were largely unfamiliar with.
Correct. And I think that I kind of use myself as some sort of an example. We had a group of young people who toured our food hub, and I was explaining to them some of these things that you just brought up. And they were like, wow, we didn't know that. I said, yeah, what's really great is now you can't unknow it. Now you know it, you have to do something about it. And so I think that, I guess when I'm looking at what's going on right now, that's what makes me feel like we need to capitalize on this and help people learn more. Now that they've got a little bit of an appetite for understanding, you need to learn it and then you need to do something about it. But you're right, I did not know. I knew a little bit, but not the details, and I won't geek out on you with, like, you know, distribution discussions and things like that, but
that might be really interesting, actually. No. Yeah, but I mean, same thing. Like, I grew up in a town outside of Cleveland, Ohio, that was, I mean, it was in the suburbs, but at one point, I think this is accurate. I'm going to say it like it's true, and then I'll have to look it up later. It was a farming community, so there were a ton of greenhouses. And what I'm going to quote, I think, is accurate. At one point, I think the Guinness Book of World Record was like the number of square feet under glass. Like they had their world record. There were so many greenhouses in that community, so many farms. And so that just gives you a sense that even though it was 20 minutes west of Cleveland, it was a farming community, and that's changed now. It's become, you know, subdivisions and strip malls and stuff. But when I was there, I went to school with kids whose parents were farmers and they worked on the farm, and we would go to their farm stand and get produce and stuff. So I was aware of that kind of stuff, but I just didn't think a lot about economic development and the role agriculture plays in local food systems and the importance of intentionally choosing what to buy and what to eat and how that supports or doesn't support your local farmer. It really wasn't until I was out of college and I started reading books about like food ethics. I read Michael Pollan's The Omnivore's Dilemma, and that like blew my mind. I was like, oh my gosh, I had no idea. And that was, you know, probably 2006, 2007. If you can make a general case, I mean, why is supporting a local food system important?
The private industry side of me says, well, it's just a simple, it's math. If you buy something here from a local person, then that money stays here versus if you, not to demonize Amazon, but like if you buy something from Amazon, that money is not staying here. So to me, I'm sure you've heard of the local multiplier effect, which is pretty substantial when it comes to food. It just makes sense. You're also feeding yourself. So from a food perspective, I know for years and years, ASD has operated the Appalachian Harvest Food Hub. One of the things that we had always experienced was that there was triple the demand that we had supply. For the longest time, it was an immediate opportunity for someone to be able to sell into those markets, even someone like me. So I was working full-time at Appalachian Harvest, at ASD, and I grew for our Appalachian Harvest Food Hub. I was wildly ignorant about growing.
What did you grow?
But I did really well because I did what they told me to do. And grew organic peppers my first year.
Okay.
I think everybody should have to do that at least once, because I swore those peppers ought to be worth $100 a box.
It's a lot
of hard work, and I think you need to do it to understand and appreciate what goes into getting food on your table.
Yeah, I've heard people say, and I might be just completely ripping off a quote from, I don't know, Wendell Berry or something, but eating is like a political act, right? Mm-hmm. We don't think about it that way, but the way we eat and the choices we make with how we spend our money and the things we put into our body and the resources that were used to get that to us are very interconnected with this global market that we participate in every day. Choosing what to do with your food dollars is an act, whether you're cognizant of that or not, and how intentional you are, it still has implication. You know, so in the food world, you have more food is purchased at Walmart nationwide than anywhere else. I think that's the largest seller of groceries to Americans. And we have regional food market groups like Food City in our region who would still be, you know, it's not a local farmer, it's just a regional grocery store chain. But there's maybe the opportunity to work with a Food City to get local products into a store where there might not be the opportunity for a group like yours to have those kinds of conversations with like a Walmart to get products in those stores. How does what you all do, I mean, are you just interfacing with farmers and then things like CSAs and farmers markets, or do you interact with grocers?
Our food hub, we started it in 2000. The markets that are here are pretty small. So we have a couple of tractor trailers and a box truck, and we go as far south as Atlanta, Georgia, and as far north as Landover, Maryland to do deliveries. And we go to the distribution centers of grocery store chains. Okay. So the reason for that, first of all, it's not that we believe that we should be transporting food out of our region, because we don't want to.
Sure.
We're going where our farmers can get the top dollar for their products and a high volume.
So you're advocating, you're like the middleman for farmers in the region to try to help them get as much return on investment for their products so that they can continue to, you know, pay their workers, feed their families,
right,
and keep their business sustainable for another growing season.
The way a food hub like ours works is you may have a grower like me who grew peppers, mm-hmm. and I maybe grew 20 cases a week. My 20 cases are not going to end up in Whole Foods in Atlanta.
Yeah.
But if you grew 200 and somebody else grew 500 and we have a mix of different products and we have enough to fill up a tractor trailer, then the maybe two boxes I grew that week actually end up on a shelf, which is pretty darn cool. Right. It's kind of neat to think that you grow food and that it's actually getting onto families' plates. But it's what's really neat is that it enables farmers of completely different scales to participate in the same markets.
Right.
I think one of the things that is probably the most challenging, I'm always looking for some sort of simple infographic that explains the entire food system. And I haven't figured out how to draw something three-dimensionally, and I can't draw.
It's complicated, right?
It's different. Some farmers have no desire. I always think of that saying, you know, you have a face for radio. I always think about some farmers don't want to interact with the public. They would just as soon sell through somebody who's going to manage all of that, and they want to do what they want to do, which is grow. And others really thrive on building those relationships with their customers. And so it takes like everything from soup to nuts on that. And there's a place in my mind, there is a place for farmers of different scales, for markets of different scales. It is not like we are doing a very good job of feeding Central Appalachians with Central Appalachian food. But it isn't that we couldn't, you know, it isn't that we couldn't have our institutions like our hospitals and our universities. They could be buying local. It isn't like we have even remotely come close to exhausting what we could do within our own boundaries.
And that's, again, part of the intentionality. It's counterintuitive from a food access standpoint that here in Central Appalachia, where we have land and space and farmers, that there's still lack of access to healthy fruits and vegetables in certain places. I mean, you do have pockets of quote unquote food deserts where people aren't accessing it, even though theoretically it's right here on our doorstep. And that goes back to just the sort of intricate way that the food system's structured. So kind of exploring again, where are those gaps and where are those potential partnerships with things like universities? I don't know all the ins and outs of what ETSU does and how they do it. I know that they have a contract with Sodexo, but you know, I don't know how Sodexo works on getting their their agriculture products. You know, so it's complicated, but at the same time, it seems kind of silly that we don't have more systems in place to keep the food where it's being grown, right in that community, feeding the people that live in that community.
And I think we've seen successful examples that work, but it takes intentionality. Yeah. And if you're working with like a Sodexo, not to pick on them, but they are a business that has a business model. And they have suppliers that they can rely on. They cannot afford to not have a reliable source of supply. And sometimes what it comes down to is having the capacity to be able to be less reliable, to have, and but then it comes back to us as consumers to not be gripey because it's November and I don't have a tomato on something, you know? And so, you know, we are as consumers at fault in a lot of cases because of what we've gotten used to. And so, you know, where we have seen that people have changed what the consumers want, it changes a lot of things. I will say that one of the things that ASD has been working on with some really great partners in West Virginia is how do we, in a rural community, knit together all the different types of markets? So if you have an institution, say a hospital, that's willing to buy a decent amount of product, that helps you get to that community to then do a drop-off for food access. That you don't make money on, but you manage to get there so that you can serve that community. And so when I look at the work that we are doing in Central Appalachia, it is about being creative and looking at all the different pieces that we could put together if we weren't just thinking like super black and white. It takes a lot more creativity to serve an area like that, and it takes a lot more partners. And people just being willing to, like, for instance, one of our partners was trying to get into a hospital system in West Virginia, they didn't have enough West Virginia product to sell to that hospital. Mm-hmm. So we sold them stuff from Virginia.
Yeah.
And we told them that if they couldn't sell it all, it was like buying it on spec. If they couldn't sell it all, then we wouldn't charge them for all of it. And it was a gamble on both of our parts.
Yeah.
Granted, it was supported with some foundation dollars, but that helped them. They only did that a couple of times. And then it was like the buyer starts actually buying, and then they start being able to collect more product from different West Virginia growers. So it's like it needs a spark, and it needs someone who is willing to take some risks. And that someone could be a farmer, it could be a buyer, a distributor, what have you.
Right. And there could be a grocery store chain, you know, operator or owner who hears that kind of story and says, oh, like, yeah, maybe I need to think about, you know, partnering somehow with ASD and help get my company connected to local farmers to carry more local produce, or a hospital system, or a university, or a, you know, a business that has a food court. I like the concept of sort of a demonstration plot, which is very agricultural kind of imagery, that like you were in this big macro system and like things are operating the way they are. And one way to bring about change in that system isn't by changing the entire system like in one swoop. It doesn't work that way. But it's like using your own little plot of the earth, kind of like do a demonstration of how it might look different, and that would be sort of appealing to people to go like, huh, well, that makes sense. Like, why don't we do that? And then somebody else replicates that. And then if it's scalable, that's the way you implement these disruptors to the system that make us, you know, hopefully make things that are an improvement to the system, that help make sure farmers get compensated fairly, that make sure that foods are healthy and that the land's taken care of, you know, all these different aspects of agriculture and food systems that we need to be more intentional about.
And I think when you go back to that West Virginia hospital, was most amusing because that particular community was not buying from any farmers. Therefore, there were no farmers. So when they first started to dig into this, they're like, well, what will we want it from our county? And it's like, no one's been buying from people in your county. So there is no one in your county. Yeah, you can change that, but it isn't going to be overnight. So like with ASD, when we work with farmers to grow for markets, any market, we never, ever, ever recommend anybody put one seed or one plant in the ground until they know where the product is going. Mm. Granted, if you're a farmer like growing for a farmer's market or a CSA and you experiment, you know, that's something that's part of your business model. But when we're growing for different markets that we serve, we know where it's going before it's planted, because it protects farmers.
Yeah.
Farmers often take the hit whenever there's more expensive things. ASD has been working to help farmers get food safety certification that they need to have in order to sell into large wholesale markets. Grocery store chains aren't paying for that. Mm. The farmers are paying for that.
Yeah.
And so when fuel costs go up, who pays for that? It's not, you know, it's sometimes some of that's passed on to consumers, but the more you are familiar with farming and the expenses that farmers bear, the more you realize farming is a calling and you need to be called to do it, because it is certainly not that you're going to get rich.
Have you seen a shift even in the last like 15 years? You hear about, just like in every sector of the economy, like the sort of consolidation, and you hear about these huge mega farms, you know, that are owned, you know, monopolized, you know, big farms, you know, buying up small farmers and trying to achieve economies of scale to make sure that it's sustainable. But at the same time, like, it's less and less individual family farmers selling to individual people in our community. So the food system of 100 years ago is very different than the food system now. Have you seen a shift in that even in the last 15 years? I mean, have you seen farmers that you worked with are no longer able to afford to farm?
It's sort of a mixed bag. I think one thing about farm consolidation in our region is we're not Nebraska. You know, we don't have these giant swaths of tillable land. So in one sense, we're almost protected, but then it is more challenging to get economies of scale.
Yeah.
Since I started working at ASD, I have seen much more awareness of local food and much more, like if you said the CSA several years ago, yeah, no one would have known what on earth you were talking about. And still, that's probably true to some extent, but so many more people understand,
yeah,
how the role that local food plays and why it's delicious or fresher and lasts longer and, you know, why they should care, I think,
yeah,
is much more prevalent now than it was 15 years ago. I also know that the average age of a farmer is, if I think last time I looked, 58 and a half or 59. And one of the biggest concerns in the circles that I am in is how are we going to replace those farmers with, yeah, new farmers who are interested in growing our food. Yeah. That probably in our area is more of a concern to me than consolidation per se. Mm-hmm. I don't know also what is going to happen with these large scale greenhouses that are coming into the country and what impact that will have on smaller farmers. There's one in Kentucky that I don't think they're operational yet, but they actually unfortunately named themselves App Harvest, and our food hub is Appalachian Harvest. So there is sometimes some confusion, but I think they've gotten like $90 or $100 million to put in like acres and acres and acres of greenhouses to do a lot of tomato production.
Hmm.
I think that's just the first of many.
Is the idea there to like, so that tomatoes could be grown there like year round? That way it's not just a seasonal thing. Like do you know what the logic is?
Some of the logic is coming from the Netherlands, which is the number two exporter in the world of produce, which I did not know until recently, which is, it's counterintuitive, but they have really perfected that whole high tech greenhouse production.
Kind of a mass production model.
Exactly. And I'm not discounting what it might look like for our food economy to have, sure, large scale greenhouses. What I would love is if it was more community owned and, right, not big business owned, so that it, you know, you, me and 12 other people manage to get together and invest in this, so that it's the profits are again staying and investing in our community.
Right.
That would, but that's a heck of a lift. I'd love it if someone invested $100 million in me, but I don't think that's going to happen tomorrow. But I think that's something that's on the horizon, or actually it's here, that will have some unintended consequences on local farmers.
Sure.
But it remains to be seen how much.
Yeah. There are people that would make the argument that population of the world is growing, and in order to feed people, we have to move towards these kind of, you know, industrial style systems of growing food. And, you know, these are, we care about feeding people. The goal is to feed people. And so I think that's all part of like a food ethics conversation, though, are some of the points that you're making about, it's not to poo-poo the idea or say you're evil or you're bad for trying to like start a business or make some money by growing food, or that you might think that that's a good model for how to feed the world 100 years from now. But that we need to ask other questions about, like, well, does it matter where your food comes from? And does it matter if you know your farmer, and does it matter if that food has to travel, you know, be exported from another country that specializes in growing these 7 products to then export to the rest of the world versus our food being more local?
And I 100% understand we're going to have a whole lot more people to feed. Yeah. We're also our farmers every year experience impacts from changes to our weather. Yeah. And when you are growing under glass, you are clearly protected from a lot of that. It is impossible to just look at something and at least it is for me. It is not black and white. It is,
yeah, sure,
it is a really complex and complicated system that I think we just have to learn more about. Much like all of the nightmare that's going on right now in our world.
Yeah.
You can't remain ignorant. You have to learn more about what you're eating, where it's coming from, what's our food system look like, what do I care about and what I don't. It's your choice to make.
So do you see part of the role of your organization is to help farmers, is to be an economic development engine for agriculture and for, you know, caring for the land. Is it also public education? I mean, do you see part of the role of your organization is to sort of like help Central Appalachia get a better understanding of food systems and how they work? Or is that just kind of a tangential thing?
That's a really good question. I would say we have not been as deliberate about that education part in some ways. Every event we ever have has local food, and we always strive to do as much local as we can, and then we try to educate people about that. So just as an example, I've mentioned our Appalachian Harvest Food Hub. We actually, in 2017, implemented an herb hub in our food hub. And that serves people who are forest farmers. Perhaps they're growing ginseng or golden seal or black cohosh, and they can bring it to our facility and process it in a certified facility. And then we can aggregate that, and those farmers can access national and international markets that they probably couldn't access on their own. The reason that we are really focused on some of that is, well, it's partly because it's an economic driver. That's a huge part of it. We also know that it's vital that we do something to provide for stewardship of plants in the wild, because they are becoming increasingly difficult to find. Yeah. So what we do is work with buyers to dramatically increase the price they're willing to pay, because it comes with a stewardship system or a conservation. It's the term that we've been using is conservation through commerce. It's like, what is it that we can do from a business side of things to change the behavior so that our forests in particular will continue to thrive? So those kinds of things. So yes, we do educate, but it's probably sometimes in more specific ways. And we could probably do a better job of stepping back and looking at more of the macro picture.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about, in light of like the COVID pandemic, where people get their sources of information.
Right.
Oftentimes lead them to very different conclusions about what's going on. And I think a lot of that in, you know, working in the College of Public Health at ETSU, this pandemic has been different than Spanish flu, or is different than SARS. We didn't know how this was going to present itself. And so the recommendations coming from CDC have evolved as they've learned more information. So that makes sense. But depending on where you're getting your news from, they may have an agenda to tell the story a certain way, to paint it more positive or more negative, or that, you know, the CDC knows what they're talking about or they don't know what they're talking about, or all these kinds of things. And all that's true for any topic or any issue. It's like you said, it's important for us to be informed. But part of that is like, well, how do you even know where to get good information from? Because it seems like everything we read or hear is biased one way or another. Yeah, I don't know how you allocate time to doing that while you're doing all the other things you are committed to doing. But it seems like in the world we're in, like hearing from local voices, I would see that as being very valuable.
Well, and some of what we do is fairly targeted. For example, as a part of the Coronavirus Act, the USDA is buying $3 billion worth of produce, dairy, and meats. Basically, they're giving contracts to certain companies that will then create these family size boxes, not like institution size boxes, that will get to nonprofits and then be distributed to families in need. And unfortunately, Southwest Virginia wasn't necessarily getting anything. And so we have been going to Pennsylvania to pick up tractor trailer loads so that we can bring it back to some of the pantries that we work with in West Virginia, Virginia, and Tennessee. Wow. And the alarm we have been sounding is you're leaving rural out. And no one thinks that it was intentional. The USDA put together that program in one week. It was crazy. And I know they worked so hard on it, but unfortunately, you know, some of the more rural communities were not served in across Central Appalachia, partly because Central Appalachia is really hard physically to serve. But I think we've been using it as an example of like, guess what? You got people and organizations like ASD and the amazing food pantries we've been working with. I mean, you give those people, I wish I could list them all right now because they're so amazing, but you give them a tiny window and they jump on it and will figure out how we can move products all around this region. That's beautiful. And I don't know that that happens everywhere, but we know that it can help us serve rural. And so what we're trying to do is have a very specific message, a very specific ask. You need to focus on this. And yeah, we are poised to make it happen. But there are some bright lights out there. Yeah. And some of it is a lot of investment from the USDA and others into rebuilding our local food system.
And so, I mean, who, like, as you try to, you know, say, stay on message, just this pointed message about one thing that can help rural food systems, who are you saying that to? Is that USDA? Is that our elected officials? Is that the business community? Is that everyone, like as many people as you can get to listen, like that this is the message that the agriculture community needs to be telling to the powers that be?
I would say the lowest hanging fruit so far has been the USDA, mm-hmm, the Appalachian Regional Commission, and our elected officials. Okay. And including in Virginia, the Virginia Department of Agriculture and, yeah, Consumer Services, and just really trying to help everyone understand the situation on the ground. When things happen so quickly, it's really easy to not see it, especially if you're in Richmond or DC. How would you, yeah, see that? And so we look at it as our responsibility to say, hey, this is what we're seeing on the ground. And no one thinks it was intentional. It just is, sure, it's just an unintended consequence. So, but we can fix it. It's getting better.
That's hopeful and that's encouraging, you know, because it can be distressing to feel helpless when things don't work as well as they could have. But the flip side is it's an opportunity to kind of like point it out and then, you know, hopefully get that improved for the future. So I'm looking at one of your emails that you sent out. Speaking of Farm Aid, it's got a big Farm Aid Keep America Growing logo on it. Mm-hmm. And it says the Central Appalachian Family Farm Fund is offsetting some of the impact of the, you know, of the pandemic. Is that what you were just talking about?
That's a different initiative. That initiative is in our area being funded by Farm Aid, and they were trying to just get some money to the ground for farmers who have been impacted by the COVID pandemic. And ASD agreed to serve as the communication point and to send checks out for, right, Northeast Tennessee and Southwest Virginia. So we have a small group that is reviewing the applications that we got.
Okay.
And what we're hoping to learn from this is just how significant are the impacts?
Yeah.
We're hearing different farmers are going to have different impacts. If you cannot get your beef processed for a year,
yeah,
what does that mean? And so that's huge. Mm-hmm. If you have a UPIC operation and you can't have anyone come on your farm, yeah, what do you do about that? So the modest amount of money that is going to be going to people is, again, admittedly small, but it also, I think, will help us understand just from learning from people where we might need to focus additional energy.
So those are kind of two initiatives that you're working on in light of COVID. Is there anything else you really would like to highlight?
We've always tried to donate food to food pantries, but we've been super deliberate about it. And since March, like mid-March, we've donated, actually tomorrow, it'll be close to 250,000 pounds of food. Some of it is us facilitating donations. Some of it is us buying product and then donating it. And some is through this USDA Food Box program. But what I am most excited about throughout that whole process is just watching all the partners come together. It's like humbling.
Yeah.
It really is. And it is not just ASD. I mean, ASD is doing the long hauls and getting the large volumes, but it's everyone coming together that has just been like, you know, there's so much negativity out there now that I just choose to focus on these fabulous people that are so committed to their communities. It's a beautiful thing.
That's great. If people want to learn more about ASD, maybe try to find a way to get more involved with your organization. What are ways that people, I know you're a nonprofit, so if people want to give money, you would love that. But do you also need volunteers in any capacity, or like what are ways that people could be engaged with you? And then how do they find you on the web?
Website is asdevelop.org. org. We do have a volunteer page that has a lot of different options. So you can express, like, I'd be interested in doing office work, or I really want to volunteer in a garden. You know, we even started a workforce development program recently. And one of the things that we really want the participants, like, enable them to have more social interactions. And yeah. So we reached out just the other day about to someone to see if they'd be willing to teach these kids how to fish. Just let us know. And there may well be a great way to plug you in. Some of the primary things are specifically stated on our website. If you are interested in gardening and never have before, or we do a lot of training around that, and then teaching people once they, if they develop a passion for it, hey, get into our farmer pipeline and maybe start going for market. We have a farmer rancher mentoring program, so that if you are an experienced farmer and would like to have an intern, then we can matchmake with that. Or if you're a person who wants to learn and you'd like to connect with a mentor, we can do all those types of things. So I would just encourage anyone who hears something about which they might be passionate to just reach out to us.
Cool. Most of our conversation kind of focused on the produce kind of things, but do you work with farmers that also raise animals or do dairy?
Our food hub is pretty much almost all produce, whole produce. Okay. But the Farmer and Rancher Mentoring Program is all different types of agriculture. So some of our interns work on beef cattle farms, some, you know, just 1 year we had someone who raised meat chickens and it was just this really cool experiment. So it's kind of all over the board.
You said you work in three different states, Tennessee, Virginia, and West Virginia. But how many counties how many employees are we talking, and like what's your budget for your organization?
We have 21 employees. Okay. And like our food hub sells around $3.5 million worth of produce a year. So it depends on the program, what our footprint is. Our programs to teach people how to garden are much more restricted to a Northeast Tennessee, Southwest Virginia footprint. When we're working with farmers to sell through the food hub, and this is partly my own background, I'm not very good at staying in a geographic area. Private industry, by and large, does not care about a county line. They care about markets and they care about, you know, what makes sense financially and for the supply chain. And so that's the way we work in Appalachian Harvest, the food hub. That's more limited to what can we make sense. So like we're working with some farmers in Kentucky that drop off their product at a food bank that we pay a little tiny bit of money to so that they can manage that. And then we don't have to pay for a facility. We want to grow that so that there's more of those farmers there. And then at some point, a facility might make sense. So the way we look at a lot of that work is if we don't work in your area for that particular program, we've been around long enough that we probably know who could.
That's great. Well, very cool. Well, any closing thoughts, initiatives that you want to make sure people know about?
The main thing I would leave with is just to be engaged. Don't be me before I moved here. Just eat. Just pay more attention. Not that you have to suddenly become, I'm only eating granola that I made and I can only eat something I grow. That's certainly how a lot of people want to live. And that is wonderful. But don't let that be the barrier to making some small changes. Any change is good, you know? And so even if all you do is like, I just want to buy my meat locally, that's a step. And so we look at it that like, it's the same with an end consumer as it is with a buyer, like a restaurant or an institution. Just take some steps and figure out what works for you in your life and what doesn't. Become more aware of the people who you're supporting. It's pretty darn cool to go to a farmer's market and have some random looking really weird mushroom that someone has grown, and you take it home and it's about the most delicious thing you've ever had. And right. And you wouldn't see that anywhere else. And so, you know, it's kind of like have fun with it. I just don't think it needs to be a beating for people. I think it can be pretty darn exciting to just get out and do something different.
Yeah. even prior to like making a practical change in how you eat, I mean, maybe the beginning for a lot of people might be that educational piece, like just become more informed about where your food is coming from or where you're shopping, and, you know, choosing a different product for a certain reason might be a good place to start. Are there any like books or resources or things that you would recommend to people who are just maybe thinking about this stuff for the first time?
Well, you mentioned the omnivore's dilemma. And I know that after I read that, I was like, good heavens, now what do you do? And I enjoyed reading, I think it's The Third Plate. Mm. And even Barbara Kingsolver's Animal Vegetable Miracle, which was a really interesting read because it, first of all, it has recipes that I thought was a genius idea, and has just like a year of eating locally was just, it's doable, challenging, but very, very enlightening, I think.
Yeah. I like, and she's Southwest Virginia, right? So supporting a regional author. So yeah, no, Animal Vegetable Miracle, I think it's just a very accessible read. Well, these are good. We'll link to your website in the show notes. We'll also link to both those books if people aren't familiar with them. Thank you so much for taking some time to talk with us, and really appreciate the good work that you do. And I'm glad we got a chance to just kind of explore some of these issues.
Well, thank you for talking with me and like giving us this opportunity. Really appreciate it.
Well, thanks to Kathleen Terry Baker for being a guest on today's podcast and for the good work she and her team at Appalachian Sustainable Development do. Please take some time to check out the show notes, where you will find a link to the ASD website, as well as links to the three books that we mentioned, The Omnivore's Dilemma by Michael Pollan, Animal Vegetable Miracle, which is by Barbara Kingsolver, her daughter Camille Kingsolver, and Stephen L. Hopp. And The Third Plate, which Kathleen mentioned, The Third Plate, Field Notes on the Future of Food by Dan Barber. There's also a link to the musician who used music you've enjoyed throughout this episode, and that's my friend Daniel Cooper. You can find his music at danielcoopermusic.com, and that's Cooper with a U. And remember, you can get in touch with me through the Unleashed Generosity website, where you can listen to all the past episodes of the podcast, and that is at www.unleashedgenerosity.org. Thanks so much for listening, and until next time, unleash your own generosity. Gotta be yourself, then would you hurry up and slow down? You don't gotta change the world, you don't gotta be someone, just gotta be yourself and love. Would you hurry up and slow down? You ain't gonna save the world, you don't gotta be someone, just gotta be yourself and love. Just gotta be yourself and love. Gotta be yourself, man. Love.